It's called bias toward action. That's what you're talking about.
But okay, so but I feel like that line still exists. That wall still exists. And am I wrong?
No, it does, and it should for most people. But there are people who aren't directly tied to, you know, what the content is actually going to be or what the story is going to be. There are people in the newsroom who work on how to create these experiences, right, who have to talk to people on the business side and should be.
And what's it like for you guys? How does that work?
I would say that there are many boundaries, but there is no wall. And I actually can't figure out... Yeah. I actually can't figure out... I mean, I did newspaper internships when I was in college, but my professional life has all been at magazines. And, there's a whole process of editors coming up with ideas that we would like sponsorship for, underwriting for, and then we take that to our sales team and they go out and sell against it. Or our sales team is like, hey, you know, like, this company is interested in underwriting like this type of content. Do you guys have anything planned like that? And we are in constant dialogue. And I honestly, it's hard for me to think about making money if that dialogue did not exist. And I think that, you know, we are a really small organization, and you know, therefore, even though my title is executive editor, I spend half my time talking to the sales team. But I don't know, in a bigger organization, perhaps that, you know, there's a way to sort of have a full team of people who exist, on either side of that line or where the wall used to be. But moving forward, I just don't see how walls get us where we need to go.
And Cohen, what do you? I mean, you obviously work with lots of companies, helping them build things, either specific products or sort of experiences and things like that. How do they in this case, how do they sort of do that thinking process and building? You know, we were talking in this case about having teams where the people in the advertising staff and the editorial people working together. Mm-hmm. What's it like with the clients that
So the way IDEO ends up, and a lot of design firms end up working, is they have multidisciplinary teams. The genius sort of outcome of that, and Justin started to talk about it, the genius outcome of that usually is that because you're not speaking the same language, so I can have a cross-functional team, right? I could have a marketing, an operations person, a finance person, but they're all still speaking the language of business. Right, so there's a lot of assumptions built into what's going on, but if you break it out and there's an anthropologist or there's an architect or there's an interaction designer, they start to question each other's assumptions behind their language, and I would probably posit that there's a huge assumption. Well, there is an assumption in a lot of the news products that I see about why people are coming to this product, what they need out of it, what are they getting out of it, and you know, we're all sitting here because we know that assumption sort of is invalid. Well, not completely invalid, but I don't pick up the newspaper to get the latest news. Example, that's an assumption that would be probably easily we would have a quick conversation that's not true. So for the clients that we help, the idea of really sort of getting to the base need that you're serving is a really important thing. So do you guys who has a Bank of America account?
Who's actually happy with their Bank of America account?
That's not this panel.
It's a different question.
Do you guys have the Keep the Change program? Does anybody know what this is? Okay, so we helped Bank of America do that. And what happened was Bank of America knew their customer really well. They said, look, we know people that have five bank products persist. They stick around. And a banking product is an ATM card, a checking account, savings account. And so what we did was we spent some time with people. This is a little bit of a long ramble, but I'm going to be done quick. We spent some time with people who, we spent some time with a lady who doesn't have a lot of money, and she was quite broke. She was living in Atlanta, and we looked at her checkbook. And
was she a journalist?
No, maybe.
Zing.
Like that. So we looked at her checkbook, and we noticed that the checks that she would write to the utility every month were rounded, because since the utility's they'll hold your money if you don't spend it all, right? Or they'll send it back to you. They'll keep a credit. What she was doing is in the summer, she was just rounding up a little bit. So when the winter came and the bill was higher, she had a surplus in her account. So now back to around to my main point. What we found out is that sometimes even though you want to save, saving is really hard. But people come to a bank and they have a savings account because they want to save, right? So you design something that helps her save as she spends money, because that's the real need. Because checking and savings and all those other things, those are commodities. So if you use that metaphor and you put it against news products, what do people really need, and what's a commodity, and how can you provide an experience that's really meaningful? Sorry, that was long.
But it's good because I feel like this leads into a very valid question, and something we've talked about before is if news organizations, media companies, if they have that mindset of thinking about the, we'll call them the user in this case, because as a product, the newspaper has been created the same way for, you know, many, many years. It's
right.
Structured the same way. And the guiding principle is sort of, we're doing this for the sake of democracy. You know, we're informing the republic. But did anybody ask, you know, the in this case, the user, like, what they want?
Right. Democracy doesn't buy newspapers.
Right there. But seriously, let's talk about this for a second. Do newspapers actually stop to ask their readers what they want? Because I don't know if that's reflected in what we see.
I think more and more. I mean, I think there's a real sort of wake up time happening right now. That's the short answer.
Short answer this time. I like that.
But isn't the answer like people aren't willing to pay for much of anything? Like,
yeah.
That's the problem?
Yeah. That's the deal. I mean, at least right now where everything can be pushed to a subsidized so fast that it's hard to figure out how to extract revenue, right? This is this is not a problem only for the journalism industry. In fact, almost every single category of this conference is undergoing this change, atoms to bits.
Sure. Yes, but they're making more money over at the convention center than we are here at the Sheraton.
This is true.
Well, let's talk about that.
Okay.
If you spend any time in Palo Alto or Silicon Valley, you run into people who are working on startups. People tend to do that sort of as a hobby in their spare time. I think that the product development model at big media organization is broken. And, you know, the Post and other big companies have traditionally sort of acquired a startup when the technology reached a certain point that it became relevant to them. You might spend, you know, a couple million dollars to acquire a company that knows how to do aggregation or personalization online. I actually think you could spend less than that and run a startup accelerator for journalism products, get 10% equity in 10 different companies, have the, you know, be the sole listener at a demo day, have the option to acquire those companies either for their ideas or for their talent. This is Google's model. They acquire companies most of the time to acquire the engineers. I think that's a product development model that should be adopted by big media.
PBX just launched, or will be launching, right?
Yeah.
This conference.
Yeah, the Knight Foundation gets that too. So they just gave $2.5 million to Public Radio Exchange to run a startup accelerator for journalism. And I think you're just going to see more and more of that, which is good.
Okay, but so the question that I think we keep coming back to in terms of if we're going to build a team to create new products for your news organization or work on special features or anything that can be money-making, how do you get those people? You know, we're talking about we want engineers and developers, people who could be making money elsewhere. What's the carrot to get somebody like that to come work for a news organization?
So this is something that's been a real epiphany for me this year. I was at this conference last year, and I was still working at the Post. And a lot of what I was doing then was I was the digital design director, but it was really about building a team. It was about finding the right talent and hiring those people and get them excited about journalism if they weren't journalists. And I did a lot of recruiting of programmers. Which was a real cultural shift for the Post to have programmers work in the newsroom. This year, when I'm hearing big media execs saying things that I used to say, the language is all around inclusion. It's about we need to include these people in the newsroom. We need to find them good seats. We need to make them feel important. I mean, what I've seen just being in the short time in California is that, you know, they already feel all of that. It's not about inclusion. It actually starts with the technologist. There are many startup incubators where you cannot apply if you don't have a chief technology officer. You can apply if you're a solo chief technology officer. So, you know, that's the only position that is a requirement for incubators. So, you know, I think that even though, you know, media is starting to reach out in these areas, the reaching out actually isn't enough. There has to be much more empowerment. It has to go much further than what I thought it was in order to have the right skill sets to create the future. Otherwise, we're just going to be selling our content to the people who are already doing that. And I don't understand why that's like, you know, when I really look at it rationally, that's not a big wake-up call. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg and Sergey and Larry, they're all programmers, and they all started these companies that now we're pitching our content to. So I would like to see, you know, programmers have executive positions in newsrooms and really drive that forward, or lead R&D groups, which is some are doing, and we can talk about that too.
Well, let's turn this on Colin then.
What?
Hi.
Hi.
So as we were talking earlier, you said that at one point you were a newspaper photographer.
Oh man, we're gonna do this. Yeah.
Yeah, that's happening.
I started my career out as a.
Well, hold on here. Let me finish the question
first, Colin. Please.
But here's the jump, because you left.
I did leave.
You moved on to something else.
I did.
What would it take for somebody like you to go back to working at a news organization?
I mean, I think I would probably start sort of a, I mean, I'd start a blog before I'd go back to a news outlet. It's so easy to self-publish. Why do I need, what am I getting out of it? I'm just being really direct and honest. So we can set up a WordPress site. I can get some friends together. We can write about things that we're interested in, and have a conversation. And then if that takes off, that was a cheap experiment. I didn't have to change my career, and I can do something that's sort of engaging. And, well, Anne's done that. Or Anne was a part of that as well, not my blog.
Yeah, I also I wrote for 5 years for a blog called Feministing, which was, yeah, I mean, exactly what Colin describes, a bunch of people with a similar point of view working together to make essentially a self-published little magazine, and, you know, making enough in advertising to sort of keep it going, and that was all well and good. I mean, I think that there's obviously a scale question in terms of the number of people that you want to reach. Your little blog, very exciting.
Yeah.
But like for you guys to quit your day job, your glamorous day job,
right.
You're going to need more people and more eyeballs and, you know, right. a way to monetize
right.
it. And I think that, you know, the issue here is, is not just, you know, like, do you want to write something because you feel like you want to say something to the world, but...
Right, so there's, I mean, the thing that's kind of interesting, so as you asked that, the thing I'm starting to think about is, look, everybody's a content creator now, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have well-respected, outlets with a serious point of view, but, you know, why aren't there more experiments? Well, there are some experiments to invite those people in. The thing that I wonder is this institution, if it needs more doors for ways to get in, ways to connect across and inside itself, that just in some ways starting to organize it differently will unlock a lot of the ways that people are naturally doing content and making things interesting. Mm-hmm. So if I can, like, who do you guys think is killing it, like, content business model wise? Come on.
Don't jump all at once, please.
New York Times.
Mother Jones.
Who's advice? You're a genius.
Excellent. You played right into our trap.
No, I think, well, we talked about it at lunch. I think, I mean, all the ones that you guys point out, Vice is also one that you might recoil if you start to categorize it too close to journalism. But the things that
Vice publishes good journalism.
They do. They're amazing writers. But the things that they do have a strong point of view and attract a very serious audience. And there are advertisers that want to be close to those readers.
I mean, I think that for us, the question is when you talk about, you know, creating this sort of multiple doors to make content, like that's all well and good. You know, we want to expand the number of voices that are associated with all of our media platforms. Mm-hmm. I think that the issue is for a place like Good that really relies on maintaining our brand and our point of view and our editorial sensibility. The more doors you create, the more nebulous that becomes.
That's a good point.
Okay. Yeah.
Well,
I have no response.
So let's talk a second about the idea of having sort of R&D teams or these kind of teams that work on special projects. A lot of organizations have these. Some of them are sort of sequestered away and they work in secret on Project X for like 6 weeks or 3 months, and then they come up and all of a sudden have some fantastic new advertising thing or a new module for the site or something like that. The question I would ask is, do we need those people to be working in real time? Do they need to be experimenting with, basically, should they be playing with live rounds instead of Nerf darts? You know, if you're expecting them to come up and work, make something for your news organization to potentially save it or make more money, doesn't it make sense for them to be working in real time?
I think you have to have both. Go ahead, Colin.
No, I agree. You have to have both. I think the speed at which all our economies are moving, that you have to be constant. Like, there's no grand plan for a business strategy that works. Like, the strategies that work are businesses that learn, right? So how can you make sure that you're trying things and learning all the time so you can evolve just as fast? And that's why I think Good and Vice and some others are so brilliant, is because they're like, hey, well, yeah, let's try a different outlet, or let's try an event, or let's try some of these things. They're just trying it, and if it hits, you'll see it again. And if it doesn't, they'll move on. But it's this thing of, to your point, like, go shoot with live rounds, because you don't have time to play around with Nerf darts.
I mean, I think the biggest problem is that these innovation teams, whether they're working in real time or they're working off-site or whatever, are mostly thinking about how content is distributed and getting it in front of more eyeballs, which is great. You know, you can put sort of traditional CPM-based advertising in it, but really they're not dealing with, like, the fundamental problem of how to make money. It's not like people are being sent away to, like, really think about, like, what are new aspects of our, like, mm-hmm. of our media platform that we can sell against in creative ways, or partner with companies to underwrite in creative ways. That's not the kind of innovation that's happening. It's really much more like a literal tech distribution, like, engineering kind of question that's being tackled. I don't feel like there's, and maybe I'm wrong. I mean, please correct me if I am.
Well, I think it depends on what segment you're looking at. So I think it happens some with the market leaders, mm-hmm. and I think it happens in the sort of startup companies too. So I was at a conference recently on digital advertising, and the guy who leads that department at the New York Times, they actually have an ad lab, and they have technologists who work for them. And I thought this was really interesting, because having been on some sales calls, up in New York myself, they don't actually go out to the Mindshares and Razorfishes anymore to pitch things. They have people come into their ad lab, and so might as well meet there, and they're showing, like, future ideas of what brand integration could be and things like that. So there are some people who are doing it, the big ones who have the money around it, and then there are people who are starting companies where they put that notion first. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I guess we're spending a lot of time talking about building the right team, because I feel like that's probably the most important thing when you either want to find new ways to make money, or, as you were saying, Anne, if they're making new content and things like that. But specifically, how important is the mission of your organization in getting the right people on board? Because it seems like newspapers, obviously, the general mission of informing readers, helping democracy, that seems very broad. But, you know, you see startup companies, technology companies, and Good, they have very specific, not very specific, but they have a more defined mission. How does that help get the right people through the door?
Can I tell a quick story that might help frame that a little bit? So, you're not going to say no, are you? All right, so about 10 years ago, I was working at a paper in North Carolina, and I was at the Barnes & Noble, and I went to the magazine stand, and this older gentleman walked in with his granddaughter, who was probably about 5 or 6, and he went to the newspaper rack, and he pulled out a copy of the New York Times, and he showed it to his granddaughter, and he said, "Do you know what this is?" And she shook her head, of course, and he said, "This is the New York Times. This is the greatest newspaper in the world. And do you know why it's so great?" And she shook her head again, and he said, "Because all they do is tell the truth." So the Washington Post was sold out, I think, is why that happened.
Was this man's last name Sulzberger?
Yeah, that's right. So then they walked away, right? And then I was sitting there for a few more minutes, and I was reading. And then the Barnes & Noble manager walked up with one of his employees, and his employee was looking for a copy of the local paper that somebody had come in and asked for. And he said, "Oh, no, we sold out of the local paper today because somebody came in and bought the whole stack." And the employee was like, "Well, why would someone do that?" And he said, "Well, she said there was a picture of her dog in the paper." So both of those models, right, used to be a reason why people would buy the paper. Now the Pew Foundation says that trust, you know, people trust mainstream media at around 22%. So trust is not the draw anymore. We need to do something about trust. This is one of the things I'm working on right now at Stanford in the startup that we're working on. And the other thing is that, you know, people wanted to see themselves. Well, you can see yourselves all over social media now. You can do that all over the place. So as we talk about what the mission is, I think it's interesting to have the frame of how, you know, the need, what people need from our companies has changed.
I mean, yeah, I think the thing is, if you're for everyone, you're for no one. like, you know, the idea that thank you, Colin. The idea that you are making media with a point of view lets everyone on all sides, from you know, readers and consumers to people you want to work with and hire to advertising partners, know what they're coming to do. And you know, and that doesn't mean, I mean, in some ways I think that, like, it's great. The scale of good is really ideal for this, you know, having hundreds of blogs that are, you know, each devoted to a niche topic, and then, you know, in 25 different sections, you know, is never a place where we're going to be, and I think that is really helpful. And as we have this sort of narrow sensibility that is creative and optimistic but rational, you know, the sort of like a few overlapping terms that we use, but you know. And so I think that in some ways a lot of these questions are specific to news organization based on size and mission to some degree. But, you know, I can't help but wonder when I look at the legacy, like the big, big legacy media, if they wouldn't do better as just, you know, a series of affiliated smaller things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, when we were kind of chatting before this panel, Justin said something that
Which Justin?
Oh. Justin Ellis said something that I still think is fascinating as well. You know, it felt like the first, as a culture, it's kind of learning. We're learning as a culture, and things are giving way. And like the first wave was, hey, we're trying to play with new types of delivery technology. And you know, so hey, browsers and the things like this. And then the second wave is sort of like trying to play with paywalls or what's going to work and what's not. And they're sort of cycling right now. Some things will stick and some things aren't. So even though we aren't individually doing a lot of experiments, we all across the culture are, which I think is really cool. And then you said, you know, I wonder if the next wave is sort of business models or organization, and when that will sort of give way. Because, I mean, much like some of the other things, the minute someone nails it and it seems to work, a lot of people are going to follow. And so depending on what your sort of profile, how competitive you are.
I mean, I disagree with that.
Please.
I mean, I think, you know, organizations of similar size, that's true. You know, like, if you know, I know that,
oh, yeah.
You know, obviously, like, there are certain sized organizations will all rush to the same thing.
Right.
But, you know, there's already places that are making it work, Good being among them, mm-hmm. and, you know, Vice being among them. And it's sort of like, you can't rush every business model toward that point.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. So Anna's right.
I mean, I think the real issue is how you create the environment for that discovery process to happen, right? So the answer is different depending on what market you're in, what size you're in. But most people, I mean, a lot of companies need to create the environment for them to be able to get to that place. Mm-hmm. And that's what organization design is about. That's what design thinking helps people do.
But as you solve the problem, and I mean, if you get too close to the problem, you can't see what's going on. Mm-hmm. So as you figure out a way to find some space and look across at different models, the things that are interesting at Vice will show up, because you'll kind of separate the model from the content.
Which is why you need both, right? That's why you can't work on the future part-time, so you need somebody who's full-time working on the future, and then you need people to be able to rapidly test those ideas in a live newsroom, and you need those teams to work together.
We're going to open it up for questions pretty soon, because we want to have lots of feedback from folks in the audience and to get your thoughts on some of the things we've been talking about, and also, as Colin asked before, examples of organizations you think that are doing well, either making money or producing good content and trying to make money off of that. One thing for the panel, though, like I was thinking about this. We've talked about news, and I think traditionally some people would describe it as an experiential product. You know, it's something where you don't really know what the value is until you pick it up, right? But that's changed, obviously, because of the way news works now. You know, you don't need to pick up the newspaper to know what's going on. But I like that idea of something being experiential. It seems like that's something that news organizations could recapture. How do we do that? I mean, because it seems like that's a way you can make money.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think that's, well, it, I don't know if it's the only way. It's one of the main ways you have. I mean, the whole, I guess it was 2009, the Pew Research study around teenagers, and I think it was Twitter or something like that, where somebody said, you know, news will find me, right? So the breaking news is almost impossible, right? But experiencing it differently or giving people different levels of dimension is right.
I mean, I also think thinking about media outlets as affinity groups is really important. You know, the idea that I read good because I see the world and I see the world in a similar way and I like the way good presents the world to me is something that I think about a lot when I think about people who are looking at our website and our magazine, which is another interesting side point. This came up earlier too. Which for us, the magazine is mostly a marketing tool, like the physical magazine. It's a way to like you put it on your coffee table in the way you'd wear a button to say like I'm with Good, and we want people to read it. Obviously, we want people to look at it. It's beautiful, but. You know, we put all of that online as well, and it gets in front of more eyeballs there. The physical magazine product is sort of like it's like a thing you get for identifying with us. And I think that point of view, as opposed to sort of like, here is why you buy this thing at the newsstand, little girl, or whatever, is a pretty key shift that has to happen.
I agree. I think there's a difference between news and publishing. I think news is a commodity. I think publishing is sort of how you analyze the news, how you make sense of it for people in particular areas that they're interested in, and the conversation around the news, and more, obviously, the social conversation around it. I think publishing is really what we're aiming for.
But I guess one thing I want to come back to is, and one of the things that you guys do is you do events, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is an event another way of experiencing news, or is that more along the lines of what you're saying of people identifying with good?
It's another way of experiencing good.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so I think we're going to open it up for questions, and if you want to ask the panel something, tell us we're wrong, please step to the microphone.
I'm wrong a lot.
Well, don't tell us we're wrong. I mean,
no,
that
I'm
would
wrong
just be
a lot. I'm good with it. I'm good with it. I'm wrong all the time.
Curious how you guys feel about the aggregators,
Flipboard, Pulse, Huffington Post. Is it a win? Is it a loss? Is it nothing?
Is it inevitable?
Just your thoughts about those.
I mean, in some ways, this is where the sort of the startup incubator stuff that Justin was talking about intersects with this, which is like, you know, what if the New York Times had built something like Flipboard first and gotten there first with how to monetize being a core part of that conversation, which I know that's a hindsight comment, not a foresight, about types of aggregators and readers like that. I don't know. I think I'm, as someone who pays people to produce journalism, I'm happy when our stuff shows up in places like Flipboard. It gets in front of more eyes. There are some that, you know, send people back through our website where we still get, you know, money from traditional ad impressions, that sort of thing. You know, mostly though, when I think about, you know, us making most of our money off of, like I said, the brand, it's good for us to put our brand in front of more eyeballs. I think that obviously that calculus is different for places that run more on, you know, just how many impressions are we serving on our site. And I don't know, there's probably a large overlap with folks who were at that curators and the curated panel a few days ago here. But that, again, I think that calculus is different for the New York Times.
I view it entirely competitively. I think it's great that Flipboard and Pulse exist. I think it's news organization's responsibility to create the next one. And in order to do that, you have to put yourself in that position. You know, Pulse came out of a D-School class at Stanford. There's a couple of students created that. You know, so why can't my organization do that? Well, it's not because we don't have the talent or the creativity. It's because of the way we're organized. It's because of the sort of internal way that you take products to market. And so, yeah, I mean, more power to you. We got to rise to the challenge. It's a waste of time to say people shouldn't aggregate or create those products, because they will.
Cool. Hi. You all talked about mission-based a little bit as well as advertising. I work for a regional tech news blog. I'm not a journalist. I'm the ops guy. Kind of came to this as a startup. I always think about what we sell online as sponsorships, not advertising.
Mm-hmm.
They're not looking to get an ROI necessarily. They want to support the mission that we're doing. And I'm curious what you think the role of sponsors, and not paying for content like write this article, like not that, I'm saying like they're sponsoring the publication. Like how does that differ from advertising? How do you utilize that in the publications you work on?
I want to see a lot more of that. I think CPMs are bad for journalism.
Yeah,
Colin, over to you.
Go on.
No, yeah, go.
No, please.
Everybody has some level of sponsorship or brand integration type work that they do on their sites, even big media companies, but it's typically really small compared to what they're getting from display. But display is increasingly it's a network game, and those dollars are getting smaller and smaller. You have to figure out how to do brand integration. You have to figure out how to do win-wins. It doesn't have to make the journalism, it doesn't have to cheapen it in any way at all. But I think, again, it's just about having that conversation up front. I mean, advertising sides have always come to media sites and said, hey, you know what, so-and-so wants to spend this money. Would you guys consider doing that? And usually that's, by the time it gets to that point, you're like, no, we would never do that. That's such a sellout thing. Why don't you have a conversation regularly? Why don't you get those people sort of working together? Again, the right people, not the reporters who are at the press conferences or covering the events. It's not a new model either, you know? I mean, I was a sports guy, and you wouldn't do a special section on the Redskins if you didn't sell it. If you didn't sell it, that's going in the regular sports section. So you've always had this sort of, you know, the win-wins work out. So.
Well, but you guys do that. You do sponsorships at Good, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I think reframing it to be sponsorships is a smarter, it's a bigger idea because it invites you to serve your sponsors differently and vice versa, as opposed to working on very incremental like placements and page views and what's my exact metric, which I think we're going to have to start, you know, admitting that it's hard to know.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, can you jump in really?
Please.
Sorry, you all have mentioned metrics a lot and sort of like measuring engagement, but one of the things, I study a lot of news organizations and how they track engagement, and I find that it doesn't happen. So we talk about sponsorships, we talk about reframing our advertising strategy, but no one's actually really thinking strategically about demographic development and actually looking at what works analytically on the website.
I mean, I think that question is different when, I mean, I guess, so this is a business panel, and I think, I mean, number one metric is, like, are you making money, right? Like what are people paying you to do? Whether those people are, like, consumers or whether those people are, like, you know, whether you want to use the word sponsors or advertisers, whatever, who is paying you how much money? Like, that is a really clear metric. And I think that it's pretty clear to me that, like, increasingly the advertiser sponsor types are not paying for ad inventory, or less and less interested in paying for that. And consumers are less and less interested in paying for anything at all. And so, you know, what it's true. So, I mean, I guess does that answer just the pure, that's not a solution in terms of like how we get around those problems. But for me, that is the metric. Like,
and I actually don't think that's true, or that there's some degrees of truth to it. There's a truthiness to what you said, I think. Because targeted advertising is clearly the future. That's how Google makes their money, right? And big media are getting into that space. So the more you have personalized news widgets on big media sites, the more you know about what your readers like, the more you can match that up with businesses that sell those types of products. And people are doing targeted advertising. So,
but they're not doing that much of it, though.
Playing catch up.
There was that the recent Pew study that said that it was like 5% or less or something. Uh-huh. So it's, you know, they need.
They're way behind.
But I think that I think for me, what's interesting in the question that was asked is, so you can use metrics to say, okay, we're tracking to plan, or we got this in front of as many eyeballs as we can. You can use metrics to say, yes, we did what we were supposed to do. Or if you can figure out how to ask different questions of your data, which is what you're talking about running your analytics, about your demographics, and figuring out what people want and what they're looking at. So now that you have all this data, instead of just saying, okay, we did what we thought we were going to do, aren't we great? If you try and figure out how to ask different questions of that data, it will allow you to find different ways to serve experiences to people. So I think you're right there. So we have to move to the next question.
Yeah. Sorry, I just have one thing to add on that before
I
ask my question.
Please.
As far as like also doing events, the nonprofit web magazine that I edit, we've been doing some events as well. We did one in New York a few months ago. And there's another like kind of intangible metric where we had about 15 or 20 people who flew from other parts of the world to actually attend it.
Oh, cool.
And so I think that's an interesting, you know, it's a lot harder to put that. You can't find that in Google Analytics.
This is kind of what I was saying about like an affinity group, right?
Yeah,
like instead
exactly.
of like I am someone who clicks on Good's articles, like when I see them as being like, I'm someone who identifies with Good and like Good's point of view. That's
right.
Exactly what you're talking about.
Turn those guys into your users so you can test future stuff with them.
Mm-hmm.
You can do empathy work with that group.
Right, right. So I had another question, about sponsorship. As far as like, it seems like a lot of the larger discussion that I hear, not just here but elsewhere, is with you know, larger newsrooms and how those lines are drawn and in a traditional way. But if you're, say, a very small, agile, maybe nonprofit publication, like Good, Good isn't nonprofit, I know, but and say distributed in different parts of the country, and you've got somebody trying to get sponsorships in San Francisco and someone in Austin who's trying to like run editorial and has some kind of editorial independence, those lines can become a lot more porous. And so I was kind of curious, and you know, sometimes one hand is not talking to the other, and you know, we're writing an article about, you know, critical about this company, and all of a sudden, before it goes to press, they become a sponsor. You know, that, and that, you know, is just kind of like workflow and distributor problem. But I kind of wanted to hear more about how a publication like Good navigates those lines when, you know, you're on a smaller staff and the lines are maybe a little more porous in both labor and in the sponsorship.
I mean, one of the reasons why I think Good's model works is because we are a magazine, you know, and whether or not that's a physical thing, it's like a point of view and a way we think about the way we do journalism. It's not like we're going to obsessively cover everything that happens in the news. It's like we're going to cover things that are relevant to our community and to our readers. And you know, so I think we try really hard to find sponsors who are not going to conflict with that. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of brands that, like I said, like want to be around Good. Like we're doing the thing next month with Levi's, and Levi's, you know, it's like we're not doing a lot of investigative anti-denim work right now. So it's, it's, you know, like, you know, there are things that, you know, we know are going to be a good match. And you know, that's like another reason why, like I said, it's hard for me to envision a world in which that wall is up completely, because it's not, you know, you have to have a two-way approach. It's not just our, you know, our ad sales team coming to us and being like, you know, hey, we sold through, you know, a bunch of stuff with Levi's, like, by the way, kill the denim series or whatever. it's more like us having a conversation up front, you know, hey, we're planning these 10 things. Here are 10 people, like companies, partners we think would make a ton of sense. Can you go out and pursue them? And vice versa. And I think that this is not to say that we never do anything that causes conflict with our sales and partnerships team. But I do think that an upfront conversation and having like boundaries instead of a wall can preempt a lot of that.
Right.
So you need like a safe word, basically.
I mean, at the end of the day, the safe word is always money.
Money. No.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Wow. I like the idea of shade-grown small-batch pants.
Small-batch pants.
Okay.
Jeans made out of baby seals. Next question.
I have a question. I think it was Justin that said something about how there should be an investment, Justin Farrell, how there should be an investment in having people working on the future full-time. Do you have a case study that you can share where the right organization was in place to protect that team from the sucking sound of the core, but yet have them integrated closely enough so that they could test stuff with the core?
Sucking sound of the core. I haven't heard that one.
So I can't use the name. So there's a large news organization that was trying to figure out how to deal with hyperlocal. And ooh. What they did was they what I do.
Easy. Did somebody just get like a buzzword bingo or something?
Shit.
We call that hyper relevant now, I think.
Hyper-relevant.
Not true.
Okay. So there was an echo. So the deal was is they created a team and they did this sort of process where they went out and tried to figure out what users wanted and how they were going to deal with it. And they were struggling with a lot of the business model problems of advertising at a very local focused scale doesn't work. So why are you going to put it in the user experience and screw things up? Maybe what you do is you start to host events and so they're trying to figure out different ways to do this. So this is an example, and I think there was a regular process of reporting what risks you were taking, what you hoped to learn, and what you'd learned back to the sucking sound of the core. But they actually had put them separate and taken it out of the same channel. Why is everybody smiling?
Well, the post has
smiling because I don't know who this big media company is.
The Post has that. The Post has that. There's an R&D group called WAPO Labs that's on the corporate side that reports directly to Don Graham. And they're the group that created the social reader.
Headed by Commander Taco?
Commander Taco is now there. His job is to work with the newsroom on how to integrate the stuff that they do. And they work closely with the design team and the guys who work on news apps and all of our mutual friends.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in that team, I guess the problem that my big news organization faces is that a lot of the development and design resources end up getting sucked back into the core because to keep the core going.
Right.
You know, if there's one, you know, down period where they're not actually coding, they're pulled back into some other project and then they kind of just get drowned. And then once the R&D team has something ready to be built, the development and design resources are gone.
Well, it's significant that the labs team was created and reports directly to Don Graham. So that won't happen with them. They're never going to move into the newsroom because nobody, right. He doesn't report to anybody else.
Yeah.
So I think you have to have a champion. Right.
Another thing you can think about is like a lot. I see a lot of different industries playing around with a hackathon model or an idea where you give somebody 2 days or so, and it can't be too precious, and you have to see what you can do.
Right.
And I think it's the act of making it not so precious, because you can quickly try and ask, well, how is this going to work in our entire system? And it becomes too big to sort of get any traction to move forward. So how can you do something to put these people together to create a structure that you can create some evidence that you can change? And that in itself starts to bring a lot of change. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Sterling, I'm from Vice.
Hi,
so
Sterling.
Thank you for the nice words.
thank you for your amazing dick jokes.
Not what I expected. Please tweet that. Colin is his Twitter handle. Please.
I'm going to get a serious topic.
Dick jokes will be trending very soon. So we're clearly a magazine sort of format, and the benefit of that is the content becomes a bit more timeless, right? And
right.
I know that, Anne, you deal with the same sort of benefit from that. The benefit is that you can derive recurring revenue from the same content.
Right.
So for organizations that are sort of predicated on a really, really high turnover of content,
mm-hmm.
what do you think the right economic model is for those? And I'd just say, if I had to think of, you know, defining the economic models quickly, it's either generating recurring revenue off the same piece of content,
mm-hmm.
it's deriving as much as you can, as quickly as you can, off one piece of content, or it's shifting that burden to consumers in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that most companies that are sort of that quick turnaround model are just on the CPM hamster wheel right now.
Right.
And I don't know what the exit strategy. I don't know how that wheel stops turning. That's not, luckily, that's not my job.
It does when you sell the CNN.
I mean.
True. We've got 5 minutes, so it's lightning round question time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if there's a quick answer for this one, but I'm just wondering.
We haven't done so well in the quick answer department. We'll meet in the middle.
We can take this up at the bar then.
Yeah. So kind of for Justin Farrell, because you're talking about getting technologists into the news organization.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, technologists are incented by money and status. And in a news organization, the status is the journalist, and the money is probably not as much as they would get elsewhere. So
right.
How do you reconcile those things?
Well, I think the status is the thing that you have to change, for sure. And then there's a segment of people who really want to work with the type of content that's produced, right? So that's where you really start talking about, I mean, the reason why it's important to me to make money for news is so that news can continue in a really big, in-depth way. The best thing about working at the Washington Post is that I know that I contribute to a difference in the world because we cover the government. And if we didn't cover the government in that way, there'd be other people that do it, but we do it a lot, you know, and we come up with stuff and they read us, and legislators make decisions based on things that we've written. And I get to work on projects like that. And that's the best thing about it, right? So you talk about that. I mean, there are programmers who are interested in those stories and working on those projects. One of the biggest projects we did in the last couple of years was Top Secret America, which was a database project that basically mapped all of the private contractors who were doing top secret work for the government. And there were 2,500 of them. And the government didn't even know that they had that many. Gates ended up thanking, you know, Dana Priest for her coverage. And that started with, you know, a data developer creating this database and interactive designers creating data visualizations about it. So, you know, you point to those types of projects and you find people who want to work on that, and you say, this is the kind of thing we want you to do. We don't want you to come in here and somebody hands you a story idea and says, please do this for me and create this widget that goes up on this page.
It's like the anti-farm bill cell.
Right.
So it's a small segment. We're not going to have thousands of engineers like they do at Google, but they're out there.
One of the readers of my live blog asks, if I was there, I'd ask Anne about the danger or maybe the seduction of that strong and frankly successful brand focus. Does the brand serve the content or does the content serve the brand, and how do you know?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe this is just sort of a liberal interpretation of the idea of brand, right? I mean, I think that when I talk about brand, it's not just like what is like an actual physical thing, like the website or whatever that companies want to be near. I mean, I think of our brand as sort of like it is, you know, creative, informative, rational, optimistic, like way of thinking about like making the world better. Like that's like what our brand is, and it's like the content should serve that as well as the partners. I hope that brand of like, you know, all those like big heady words I just listed does inform the content and continues to. And you know, we do things that I think push the brand. You know, we write about sex and drugs and things that are more vice category, but with our personal lens, with our, believe it or not, like optimistic, creative lens. And so I don't know. For me, that's not attention. I guess it's if it's more like about how the partners or the sponsors that we work with push and pull that brand identity. That's kind of a separate question, one that's answered in a lot of small, frequently tense conversations with our partnerships team. But I hope, I don't know, I hope that answered your question.
Good question, though.
Mm-hmm. I think you got the last question.
Hey, thanks. So I know that Good and I know that Vice, I've seen them, they've crowdsourced content. Mm-hmm. And I think Good does it in its project section. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, how is that working, and is there a business model there?
For us, it's more of the question of going back to this like affinity group idea. It's more about how we really signal to people, and we really sort of live out the fact that we are a community of like-minded folks. It's one of those many doors. Mm-hmm. Where I think one of the ways we get around the sort of we are not just pushing stuff out to you guys. This is sort of like a back and forth, is creating some avenues that are on brand and that are like interesting and that are, you know, relevant, broadly like news relevant, and giving people a really specific way to plug in. I think that's pretty important to get smart user-generated content rather than just throwing open the door and saying, hey, send us whatever you have, being like, we're trying to answer or solve for a specific question today. Do you have thoughts about that? Do you have a new design for that? You know, and so that's how you can engage with your community without it being like a something that ends up being off-brand or not making sense on your site.
All right, well, that's it. Thank you all so much for coming. We had a good time. And
thank you.